All right, DSM-5. What do you guys think the DSM-5 is? Yes. That's right. There's more to it, though. It's the Diagnostic Statistic Manual of Mental Disorders, version 5. That's right. That's what it is. Anybody else know anything about it? Good or bad? I'm sorry? Yes, it's a book of guidelines that meant to help those in psychology, psychiatry, and medicine in general put a diagnosis or a label on individuals who come in who have problems with behavior or thinking or emotions. You know, this year I decided to go to Germany. I know, I decided to learn German. Yes. It's not new to me. I spent 2 solid years in school, in college, you know, 5 hours a semester learning German, translating it. The Besuch der Alte Dame by Rainer Maria von Rilke. It wasn't really a bad story for a guy with the name Maria in the middle. Sort of like that Johnny Cash thing, you know, the boy called Sue. Yeah, that's right. I decided to learn German again. I bought this thing called Pimsleur, and I'm driving down the road, and I'm speaking German. Because I think I'm going to Europe this summer if everything works out and they quit killing each other over there. Wanted to spend a week in Paris or a few days in Paris and then maybe go on to Germany and visit a friend. And I am tired of traveling in foreign countries without being able to speak the language, you know, or understand what they're saying to me. Eventually, I might teach in Germany. I think maybe somebody's asking me to come in 2018, and I'd love to be able to talk to them in their own tongue. That would be neat. Which brings us to tongues in this Klang Association way of dealing with the introduction. In 1 Corinthians 14, Paul tells us or speaks of the problem of uninterpreted glossolalia. That means tongues speaking without an interpreter. Nobody there to tell you what the individual was saying if they were speaking in a foreign language. If I speak in, and he said, if I speak in a language that's not interpreted, it really isn't much use to those who hear and do not understand. And of course, by now, that little voice in your head is saying, well, are you ever going to get around to explaining to us why you're talking about this? Well, the Diagnostic Statistic Manual, you know, there's a ring right now, and maybe the sound guy. The Diagnostic Statistic Manual of Mental Disorders is really nothing much more than a foreign language. It means very little. Most of it means very little to us. When we hear words like depression and anxiety, we have a good idea what the speaker means, in the same way we might know what Auf Wiedersehen or au revoir means. At the same time, if someone says borderline personality disorder and then asks us to precisely define it, we shrug. Much in the same way if someone said, Entschuldigen Sie mich, wie viel Uhr ist das? You know, it's like, what in the world does that mean? I hope that knowing some German will make my travels more interesting in the future. And I would tell you that knowing something about the DSM-5 may not only be useful to you as you counsel people who come in with labels, but it may be very important to the counselees that you care for. 2 years ago, I was asked to participate in the counseling for an individual whose problems required that we give an account of the counseling we did to a state agency while we were doing it. For that counselee, it was vitally important that I would be able to tell that agency what was going on in a language that they understood. That involved me knowing something about the DSM-5. And for the counselee and her family, it was life-saving. It really had nothing to do with the way that I counseled her or her family. It just affected what I said and how I said it to the folks who were keeping track of us. When I was asked to write this lecture, I was asked to write this lecture and give it at the February conference up in Lafayette. I was really pretty certain I'd drawn the short straw of life, you know. I get to speak about the DSM-5. That's better than general anesthesia or something like that. You know, I'll be lucky if people aren't drooling before the hour is over. And so I immediately wrote him back and I said, well, what in the world is it that you want these people to know at the end of the hour? You know, if you could tell me what it is you'd like for me to tell them, then maybe I can find my way through this for you and me both. And he said, he gave me three questions. Yes, he gave me three questions. First was, what are the key assumptions that are made to determine the organization of the DSM-5? How did they decide that they'd make the DSM-5 look like they decided they'd make it look like? So, the first thing to understand about the DSM-5 is the main goal of the book is to describe and set the criteria for mental disorders. First person in our country to take a crack at that was Benjamin Rush. Anybody here know who Benjamin Rush was? Who? What was he? Who was he?
He was back in Benjamin Franklin's
time. Yes? He was a signatory of the Declaration of Independence, and he was a physician. Yes. And he's also known as the father of American psychiatry for a rather quirky reason. The reason why it's kind of quirky is because Benjamin Rush ascribed to that Hippocratic theory of humoral imbalance, and he believed that bleeding people who were ill would help put their humors back in balance. In fact, he believed in it so much that people eventually figured out that you might live longer if you did not go see Dr. Rush. Yes, and he sort of became, he had lots of time. And so since he had lots of time, he started to write down descriptions of people who were considered at the time to be insane. And from that was the first historical in the United States recording of, you know, just symptom and descriptions and history descriptions of people who had mental struggles. Now, what does the DSM-5 say about itself? Well, I can tell you that it talks about mental disorders. They do not talk about disease. That was kind of a rocket for me. Let me see what the next slide is. Yes, mental disorders. Mental disorder, and they say on page 20 in the DSM-5, which is this thick, costs like $90 or something like that in paperback. I wouldn't know what getting it in hardback would be. A mental disorder is a syndrome characterized by a clinically significant disturbance in an individual's cognition, thinking, emotions, emotion regulation, and behavior that reflects a dysfunction, an abnormality, in the psychological, biological, or developmental processes underlying mental functioning. Mental disorders are usually associated with significant distress or disability in social, occupational, and other important activities. Absent is the word disease. Also is absent any notion about cause or the idea of pathology at the cell level. By doing this, they make it less difficult to classify behavior, feelings, and actions into categories. Now, the problem with that is that for most all of the diagnoses in the book, there is no test or pathology to be understood. So that's the first thing to keep in mind about the DSM. It is a classification of disorders, and there is no pathology, very much. There are a few things, but not very much. Then the next thing about it is that they are big on reliability. Now, this reliability isn't the nice neighbor that lives next door to you that you consider a real, you know, solid rock guy, and he's always reliable to do what he does, and he's always reliable to come and help you. That's not what they're talking about. Reliability in this case means that every time you have a counselee who presents with the problem or a set of them, that you can go to the book and compare their thinking and their acting and their feelings to the category in the book and arrive at a diagnosis. All right? Reliability means that 10 out of 10 times, you know, that if someone showed up in different clinics, those 10 clinicians would all arrive at the same diagnosis. That would be 100% reliability. Now, the DSM-5 makes no claim to 100% reliability, but that's what they aim for. Same person, same problems, same diagnosis. And I would say that's the most important aspect of the DSM-5. It grows or grew out of the utter confusion that was psychiatry between 1920 and 1950 at the behest of Sigmund Freud, you know, who certainly must have hated his mother, and who thought that just about every problem that we faced in mankind had something to do with not getting along with your parents or mostly your mother. So, reliability. Then, the next thing that you need to know about the DSM-5 is the inability to validate. There are 300 diagnoses in the DSM-5 and classes of diagnoses, which the classes of diagnoses was their gaming the system in order not to have more than 300, you know, because there's been a lot of criticism that every time they reprint this book or they revise it every 4 or 5 years, that the number of psychiatric diagnoses go up by 10 or 15%. And so the way they avoided it this time was they put a bunch of stuff together in categories. And so that if you get bipolar, you know, in spite of the fact that they'll have 5 or 6 different kinds of bipolar disorder, there's only one bipolar diagnosis, so that we kept under the 300. Now, the important thing you need to know about the DSM-5 is that while it can be very reliable between observers, unfortunately, that doesn't make it right. Validity is a completely different scientific term that applies to all of this. It's one thing to consistently make the same diagnosis every time you see the patient. It's quite another to be correct for that diagnosis to be true. And validation is what does correction. In medicine, when I see a patient, the first thing I do is take a good history. I listen long, or as long as they need. And at some point in time, I decide what they tell me, what I think is a matter. And then I put them up on the table. You know, it's time to get up on the table. I've done all the history taking I need right now. And I examine them. So I have a working diagnosis. They tell me they had a sore throat. They've been running a temperature of 101. Don't have a runny nose, not much of a cough. And what am I thinking? Well, I'm thinking it's likely they have a strep throat. And so I take my tongue blade. I threaten them with my tongue blade. Most people, you don't need to use the tongue blade, because if you just point it at them, they open their mouths really wide and stick their tongues out. Other people, and it's genetic. It's not, you know, it's not a matter of character. Some people, I can look down some people's throat and see the inside of their belly buttons, and other people, when they open their mouths, all I see is the back of their tongue, and then I have to go in and kind of push it out of the way. But let's say that I do, and what do I see? I see a red throat. I listen to their lungs. It's clear. I poked on their tummy. I checked their neck, and got a few lymph nodes there. You know, looked to see if their feet are swollen and stuff like that. Looked at their skin to see if there's a rash. Didn't see one. And so my working diagnosis at that point in time becomes, well, this is a sore throat. It's either strep or a virus, one of the two. And so then I have to validate it a little bit more, don't I? And how do I do that? I call up the hallway to Kelly. She comes down with that swab, sticks it down their throat, goes in and does the rapid strep screen. And then within about 10 minutes, I'll know one way or the other. Is it a strep throat or if it's just a virus? If it's just a virus, I'm not going to give them that 10 days worth of antibiotics that they're hoping to get. Why? Because it will do them absolutely no good and just add to the bacteria in the world that are resistant to that antibiotic. If it's positive, I'll treat it. That is validation, all right? And almost none of the diagnoses in the DSM-5 have any way to validate them, period. Very few. Such things like Alzheimer's, Huntington's chorea, Lewy body dementia, those kind of things, you can validate the diagnosis. Unfortunately, a lot of times it's at autopsy, but the diagnosis can be validated. Most all the rest of it cannot be. So, the inability to validate. Let's look on. Then the next thing that comes up is that this book has nothing to do with treatment. If you look at the DSM-5, there is nothing. All it is a list of symptoms, and comparing the person to the list of symptoms, you end up with a diagnosis. But it doesn't tell you why the person gets it, and it doesn't tell you how to treat it. Period. And you go, well, why is this useful? Well, it does help standardize the diagnosis. And in the 1970s, when psychiatry was really still in kind of a mess, there was a guy who ran a study, and he sent actors to different mental hospitals to act like they had whatever disease that the that he wanted them to, and they would all learn what the symptoms were, go in and act like it and get the diagnosis and be stuck in the mental hospital until somebody came to rescue them. And then he published it, and it was quite a scandal at the time. So, you know, this book was aimed at that not happening in great part. And then the other use of it is that it provides codes that people can charge money for seeing patients for. And that really is, that really is the bottom line of it. If you don't have the code, you can't charge the bill. Which in part, you know, I always say that they revise this book every 5 years, and part of the reason why they do is because maybe they do learn more. But you know, at the bottom of it too is that if you revise it every 5 years, that means everybody in the country who has one has to buy one. It's a gold mine. It's like an ATM. Not being critical, just making a notation. So the book has nothing to do with treatment, but at the same time, and it doesn't. But at the same time, it has everything to do with how people are treated, because in order to get any medicine approved through the FDA, that medicine has to have. Be able to prove that it has to have a diagnosis that represents a disease and has to show that it can affect it in a beneficial way. And the only way that you can get a diagnosis for a new diagnosis is to get it into the DSM-5 or into the IDC 11 or 12. You know, that's how it happens. And if you can't get your diagnosis into there, you'll never get your medicine or your device sold. You know, so and even though they don't treat, they in an indirect way they control how things are treated. So, what do we know about the DSM-5 now? First off, it's not disease; it's disorders. The big deal for the people who write it is reliability. You know, but you can be reliably wrong. You can be wrong every time. You can be wrong 10 out of 10 times, but you're reliable. There is no validity to prove the diagnosis, and then the DSM-5 carries no treatment. That's the first question. Now, what was the second question? When a person says they're depressed, bipolar, or schizophrenic, what does the DSM-5 say about them that is true and about their behavior? That's an interesting concept. You know, I think at times we in biblical counseling have spent a lot of time being very critical of the DSM-5, and I am guilty. You know, my favorite disease in the DSM-5 these days is dysfunctional mood dysregulation disorder. Guys know what that is? It's childhood tantrums, DMDD. Yeah, it's a disease, and my grandchildren have it. And it's probably genetic. And my dad, though, had a very concrete way of dealing with it, you know. And his acronym for it back then, though, was BRAT. Yeah, BRAT, BRAT. That is what opens the DSM-5 up. You look at it and you laugh, you know. It's like they make things into disease that aren't. All right, but sometimes they say things that are absolutely spot on, and when they do, we should recognize that and understand it, because you really do want to know what it is that the person thinks they have and what that label represents. You'll probably want to know that. So, let's start with depression. The question is whether or not the following description of depression is accurate, and does this always represent disease? All right? That's the question before the house. So how is depression described? You have to have 5 of the following symptoms for 2 weeks, and it has to represent a change in function. It includes a depressed mood or a loss of interest or pleasure in activities. That has to be present. You know, when you look at that and you would say, well, there's nothing really too wrong there. You know, I mean, that's a fairly reasonable statement to make about somebody who's depressed. 2 weeks is a little short, and it is a good criticism of it. But it's still, you know, someone can be depressed, and they would look just about like that. Then you need to have 5 or more of the following criteria. And that includes a depressed mood almost every day, You have to have a markedly diminished interest in pleasurable activities most every day. You have to have 5 out of 7, I think, significant weight loss when you're not dieting, or significant weight gain. Sleep disturbances, inability to sleep or oversleeping nearly every day. I've never suffered from oversleeping. I don't know about you. Psychomotor agitation or retardation nearly every day. That means you're agitated, or you're just sitting around in the corner not wanting to talk or do anything. Complaints of fatigue or loss of energy nearly every day. Feelings of worthlessness and guilt. Diminished ability to think, concentrate, and make decisions. Recurrent thoughts of death. Thoughts about suicide. Does this sound reasonable? Does this sound like a reasonable description of depression? Somebody who is depressed, do you think that they would fit into this description? Or do you guys have a different view of what depression is? Shake your heads up and down or this way, one or the other. Most of you are shaking your heads yes, yeah. So far, this is not an unreasonable way to describe this, except, as I've noted, for the two-week thing, because there's a trick to it. All right. Then these symptoms have to cause problems at work, at home, and at school. They can't be due to the effects of a medicine or a substance, and they can't be in the presence of another illness like schizophrenia. And they can never have had mania. Mania being that, manic depression, bipolar disorder, 1 2-week period of time when you stay up all night for 2 solid weeks and you think rather grandiose thoughts about your business abilities or other kinds of abilities. You make disastrous business decisions, disastrous moral decisions, spend money you don't have, etc. But you can't have had that in order to get the diagnosis of depression. Now, substances, an important point. Now, what I'm about to say shouldn't be taken by anyone to encourage you here to quit taking your medicine that your doctor has prescribed without consulting that doctor first. I always put that in because people somehow get the idea that I'm trying to encourage you to quit everything. I don't think that, and nor should I want any of you to think that I think badly of you if you take medicine, because I don't. I'm a doctor. I write prescriptions. I'm not a Christian Scientist. But we live in an age of medical polypharmacy. You know what I'm talking about when I say polypharmacy? When I was a young physician and I started in 1976 in a private practice, I took over a practice for a man who had people on 12 to 18 different medicines, most of them described in the PDR at the time as being, not considered to be effective for anything. And I spent most of the next 5 years weaning people off those medicines, taking them off of them, because they really didn't need them and they really didn't do anything about it. And we called that polypharmacy. Now, today the same thing is happening. Now, most of the medicines that people take today work, actually. They do things. And a good number of people who need them, but we have large numbers of people who are taking 5 to 10 different medicines a day because of hypertension, adult onset diabetes, elevated cholesterol, worn out knees, any number of things that you can think of. And those medicines interact and have side effects. I always say now that when people come in and they tell me that they have a new symptom or a new problem, that my first inclination is not to think about what new disease they might have. What I'm really interested in is what medicine are you taking and which one of them has that side effect. That's really the direction my brain runs. So while the DSM does not use the term illness or disease, most of us begin to think in medical terms once someone says they have depression. And this is where things can get very tricky. Am I medically ill because I've met the above criteria for 2 weeks, or am I suffering from the effects of losing my job, my boyfriend, or the side effects of the medicine I'm taking for hypertension, diabetes, or chronic pain? The other problem that we run into with this diagnosis of depression is normal sadness and grieving. It's a major blind spot in the DSM-5. because the DSM-5 does not give any credence to the idea that people can have a sad mood for a reason. In 1980, they took out all criteria to be depressed for cause. When I was in medical school between 1971 and 1975, we would tell you that if you can tell me why you're sad, if you can tell me what you lost, if you can tell me when this began, and if it was connected to some major loss in your life, then we wouldn't say that you had major depression. We would say that you were grieving over the loss. And that was true, and it still is. And the DSM-5 doesn't recognize that at all. And it says that after 2 weeks, if you're grieving over the loss of a loved one, that you could still be diagnosed with depression. I don't know that any good psychiatrist would do so, but other people might, you know, who are not quite as skilled. So it's the difference between normal and disordered sadness. Disordered sadness, sadness that people would come in and say, I'm depressed, and they can't tell you why. They always have been. It kind of comes and goes, but they're mostly unhappy. Those were the individuals we said who had depression. So, you know, the error or the main problem with the current DSM-5 criteria for depression is that it leaves out sadness over loss, sadness for cause. From 1980 until this last revision, which I think occurred in 2013, if I remember right, I think that's when it came out or when it was being done or finished, there was an exemption for grieving for 2 months, you know, and it was bereavement. If a woman lost her husband, she had 2 months to get her act together, get over it, which is really kind of funny when you think about it. I've never met anybody that suffered any significant loss that was over it in 2 months. And so if you're still struggling at the end of 2 months with the loss that you've suffered, then you can be diagnosed with depression. In the fifth revision, they took that out. They have no exemption for anything, you know, from a cause viewpoint. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a major error. And as a result, if you read some researchers, they'll say up to 90% of the people who are diagnosed with depression in the United States today are simply grieving over loss. You know, they are sad for loss, and the losses can be large, just about anything you can think of. As I've said before, anything you think you can't live without, you can lose. And when you lose, you can become sad. So then what can we say about the DSM-5 and depression? I would say that the description, the criteria that are laid down are reasonably useful, except for two things. One is that the shortness of the onset, you know, only 2 weeks. I would find it hard to want to make a diagnosis of depression based on just 2 weeks of being sad. And the other is that there is no recognition that individuals who've lost something important in their life may struggle for years afterwards over that loss and really not be ill and not have a disease. I think one of the best biblical example is Hannah in the Old Testament, who was infertile, who was married to a husband who had another wife. You know, you talk about a complicated life. The other wife had lots of children and who would make fun of her because she didn't. And if you read the account, it says that she would go up to the tabernacle to make the offering year by year, and she would just sit there and weep all the time. And she wept a lot at home, and her husband would say, am I not better to you than dozens of children? And she would go boo-hoo-hoo, you know. And if she were alive today, after several years of that, she would have been diagnosed with what? Depression, entirely. And you know, the problem was, of course, is if you read the text, it says that the Lord had closed her womb. This was a providential sovereign act of God in her life, and when God finally decided to let her have children, her sadness went away, and her life changed dramatically. She and her name actually means grace. You know, if you don't know that, Hannah actually means grace, and it fits perfectly the story, because you know, Hannah went from being, the good part of the story is that Hannah went from being the woman who said, give me children lest I die, just like Rachel, just like Jacob's Rachel, to the woman who, having had that child,
would take, when he was old enough, it says when he was weaned, she would take him to the tabernacle and leave him with Eli. This is the woman who couldn't live without children, who came to be the person who could, while praising God for the opportunity, take that child and give him back to the Lord. Now that's the change is, and that's grace. But, you know, so, I mean, Hannah could have been mistakenly diagnosed with depression, placed on medicine that would have done her absolutely no good, period. You know, because the thing that did her good was when God changed what was going on in her life. Then he asked me, well, what's true about bipolar disorder? And my first answer to that is mania. Mania is that distinct period of time that people have where they stay a week for a couple of weeks, and as I said, they spend money they don't have, they make terrible moral decisions at times, they have grandiose statements about themselves. I recently have talked to two different bipolar people, one manics, bipolar disorder one who was manic at the time I was talking to him, more or less, and who'd been in the hospital until the day before he came to see me, and who still was manic. I mean, he would make statements, and there was nothing I could say that would convince him any otherwise. And and he had a very high opinion of his theological ideas. You know, he believed that he was getting messages straight from God, which is often a theme for people who are manic. And when I told him that, you know, really, truly, if you wanted to hear God speak to you, what you really need to do is open your Bible and read it out loud, because God is not talking audibly to anybody right now. He then took me to that passage where it says your old men will dream, your old men will have visions and your young men will dream dreams. And that's me. And I said, well, I mean, you know, that's your interpretation of it. But, you know, there are other interpretations of it that don't support what you're saying. And at that point, he considered me to be a heretic, I think, or something or other. And that was the last counseling session. And I do note that he is lurking on my LinkedIn website. You know, I have a presence on LinkedIn, and he has visited and looked at my stuff on LinkedIn. So I know that he's still there, but there wasn't a thing I could do for him while he was manic. And then there was the next guy that I talked to just a week ago, who is manic, was not manic, but has mania and understands it entirely and knows that if he doesn't take his medicine, he will have really bad difficulties in his life, and takes it. And even though he says, about 6 months out of the year, I really don't think I need to take it, but I wrote myself a letter to remind myself that I can't stop. And that's, you know, that is due to a disease disorder of the brain that we have not clearly defined the pathology of yet. I think the day is coming. The reason why I think the day is coming that we will define the pathology is that in January, I was talking about this at dinner, in January there was an article published in the journal Nature, and it was about the genetic differences among schizophrenics that affected C4 and their complement change, which affects their immune system, which is probably the source for the raging destruction that goes on in their brain that results in the hallucinations and the delusions and the decline in function that they have. It's like that was like somebody reached in and kicked open a dark door and shed light into the room. If we come to understand the pathology of schizophrenia, and I think we are on the door of it, then we will be able to order tests, and we will be able to maybe even figure out how to cure it. And I believe that within the decade, it will no longer be a psychiatric disease, because it'll be probably an immune disorder, you know, an autoimmune disorder like lupus, and that there will be treatment for it. Maybe even the opportunity with the first psychotic episode to make the diagnosis and then treat it and stop it in its tracks. I believe that's coming. And the reason why I think that bipolar disorder may not be far behind is because if you look at they share common problems, you know, the psychosis, the delusions, the distorted thinking. And if you look at and if you look in the history of medicine, there are two diseases
which are always talked about if anyone writes about mental disorders. If they write, you know, if it was Hippocrates writing about insane people or Benjamin Rush writing in the 1700s, two things will always show up, and it was mania and schizophrenia. Everything else changes with time, you know, as far as diagnoses, but those two are certain. So anyway, so let's look at the rest of the description. All right. During that period of mood disturbance, they'll have increased energy, an inflated sense of self-esteem or grandiosity. I can remember talking to a lady who was somewhat manic, and she wanted to quit taking her medicine. A lot of times they do want to stop taking their medicine, and her husband wanted her in counseling. And the reason why he wanted her in counseling was he wanted her to keep taking her medicine because he didn't want her to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and sweep the floor. You know, she wanted to work a day job, and she wanted to work nights and go to school all day, you know. And frankly, people who have manic depression, they need to be in bed at night, asleep at night, and awake during the day. Fighting against the diurnal rhythm is bad news for them. But anyway, when I would tell her that she should continue to take her medicine, she would look at me like I was just stupid, you know. And the impression I got was that she's sitting there thinking that if you could just think as fast as I can, and if you were just half as smart as I was, you would understand why what you're saying is so dumb. You know, that was just what the impression I got, and that is the inflated sense of self-esteem and grandiosity. They just know more than we do. The decreased need for sleep. More talkative than usual, or pressure to keep talking. The both of the manic counselees that I've talked to in the last couple of months, you know, it is with the first one, I had just to interrupt him. I mean, there was no way I was going to get to say anything for an hour if I didn't interrupt him. With the second one, at least he would take a breath every once in a while so that I could get in and talk. They have a flight of ideas or subjective experience that their thoughts are racing. They are distractible. They have a hard time getting focused and staying focused on any one thing. They have increased goal-directed activity, either socially, at work, or sexually. Like the young man that I talked to who really thought he was really pretty smart business-wise, and he was working in a car wash, and he was going to launch an IPO to buy it. You know, and it wasn't just one car wash. It was a major chain of car washes. He would send, his parents found out about it before he could get it done, but he was offering to send a jet up to pick his brother up in Chicago to bring him down for a basketball game in Indianapolis. Similar problems. Excessive involvement in activities that have a high potential for painful consequences. When you run your charge card up to $30,000 for stuff that you'll never use, that can be very painful. And the mood disturbance is sufficiently severe to cause marked impairment in social occupational functions or to necessitate hospitalization. Now, the question is, do I think that this is a good description? And the answer is yes. They do say that the episode can't be attributable to a substance, and that can either be an illegal drug or it can be a... antidepressant. You know, antidepressants can cause manic episodes for people who have bipolar disorder 1, but so does marijuana. And this is for my rant for the evening. As a physician, I know that we've spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to convince people that smoking is hazardous to their health. And now what are people all over the country trying to say? That smoking marijuana is okay. And you know, and my response to that is, boy, how stupid can you be? You know, smoking anything's bad for you. One, smoking marijuana is really bad for you. Why? Because actually we have brain scans that shows that it changes brain structure in people who smoke it regularly. It changes brain structure and also brain function. The truth of the matter is if you smoke marijuana for 10 years and I give you an IQ test at the beginning and I give you an IQ test at the end, you're going to be dumber. That was what the movie was about, wasn't it? Dumb? Yeah, and dumber. The IQ will go down. The other thing that we have noticed for certain is that there is an increased incidence of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder among young people who smoke marijuana. And the
My concern is that it is that change that we have seen in the actual structural change in the brain that may be leading towards it or causing it. So if the individual is doing drugs, smoking pot, you can't call them bipolar until they're off of it for a while, and absolutely can't until they're off of it for a while and they recur. You know, that's usually how it goes. All right. Again, if the manic episode is caused by an antidepressant treatment or by electroconvulsive therapy, you're not supposed to call them bipolar disorder 1. Now, what do I think about that description? I think that's a reasonably good description. Two things about it that I think are less sure have to do with the fact that I think... probably prior to 1980, in order to get the diagnosis of manic depression, you had to be in the hospital for 2 weeks. You had to have a manic episode, which was severe enough to put you in the hospital for a couple weeks. And that really reduced the number of people who got the diagnosis. Mania is a fairly clear thing. It only occurs in 0.1% of the population of the United States. Take everybody in the country, it's 0.1%. Most of the diagnoses of bipolar disorder do not have mania with them. Clear-cut, well-defined mania. So I think that this aspect of the definition diagnosis of bipolar disorder is not a bad one. So you could look at that, and it would give you a reasonable impression of what was going on. All right? Now, what part of bipolar do I think is less true? Well, it's hypomania, bipolar disorder 2, and all the rest of it. To make the long story short about bipolar disorder 2 and hypomania is that I think that most of the people who get the label of bipolar disorder 2 either really have bipolar disorder 1 and someone's really not asking the questions correctly. You know, that's what I find. I was talking to a fellow I was talking to a week ago. First, he tells me he has bipolar disorder, too. But when I started talking to him, this guy clearly had manic episodes. I mean, you know, his understanding of it was incorrect. And I don't know if his physician had incorrectly informed him or if he just didn't hear it right. But the folks with bipolar disorder 1, I think, have a real disease. And then I think all the rest of it, when it doesn't include the two, you know, the blatant manic episode, I really think that what they have is overdiagnosed depression with the side effects from the antidepressants that they take. If you read the side effect profiles of all the SSRI antidepressants, what you're going to see is a description of hypomania, more or less. And hypomania is it what it is. Well, let's just go through the criteria real quick. It's a distinct period of elated, expansive, irritable mood that lasts 4 days, nearly every day. Just 4 days, not 2 weeks, and these people aren't up all night. They do have increased energy or activity, but then they have to have three or more symptoms that follow, and they are inflated self-esteem or grandiosity, a decreased need for sleep, and they changed the criteria that they feel rested after 3 hours. It used to be four. Anyway, these people are sleeping. They are not staying up all night like the manics do. The guy that I talked to a couple weeks ago said, yeah, I'd be awake for 2 weeks. I won't sleep at all. You know, and what happens then is someplace down the road he starts seeing things and hearing things that aren't real. More talkative. The guy was talkative, but he wasn't. He didn't talk so much that I couldn't get in and talk to him. They have a flight of ideas. Fellow that I was talking to would clang along from one thing to another, somewhat distractible, having an increase in goal-related activity, again, excessive involvement in activities that have a potential for painful consequences like spending money you don't have. It is supposed to represent an unequivocal change in the person's behavior, has to be observed by others. Episode is not severe enough to cause marked impairment. And it doesn't have psychotic features. That means that they aren't going to end up in the hospital with psychosis. And it can't be due to the physiologic effects of another substance, which, again, is back to the the issue about whether or not the antidepressants that are so freely prescribed and taken in the United States aren't the source of this problem. All right. So, you know, what is hypomania? It's a made-up word. Comes from the Greek, hypo meaning below, hupo in Greek, and minus thai meaning for I am mad, and it was below madness. And in essence, it was not quite as much mania as mania is. And I don't believe it's diagnostic for anything mostly other than the side effects of the medication that we give people all the time for antidepressants. All right. So what do I think of the criteria DSM-5 when it comes to bipolar disorder? I think it's fairly spot on for bipolar disorder 1. I think after that, if it doesn't include mania, then it's probably not very reliable. Then we come to schizophrenia. And as I told you, the world's abuzz with that new research. And if you're interested in that research, just go to Science Daily and type in schizophrenia and hit the button, and it'll pop that article up for you along with other articles about schizophrenia. I was at a meeting in December, and I was in a panel group discussing the definition of mental illness, and it really wasn't going very well for me. The other guys didn't agree with me very much. But I said that the pathology of schizophrenia, I was asked, well, if you want to have pathology all the time, when do you think the pathology for schizophrenia will be defined? And I thought about it a moment, and I said 5 years. And the guy looked at me and laughed and said, it'll be 500. And I was wrong. It wasn't 5 years. It was like a month. You know, the article got published a month later in January. So what does the DSM-5 say about schizophrenia? And here's what it says. You have to have two or more of the following symptoms. You have to have delusions, hallucinations, disorganized speech. Anybody here have a loved one, a friend, or someone you know who is schizophrenic? All right. All the rest of you know them. You just don't recognize it. They're the people on the street. You know, a good number of the folks who are homeless and live on the street, they are schizophrenics. And the reason why they're on the street is because the Supreme Court in the 1970s decided that it was unconstitutional for us to hold people against their will in mental hospitals and force them to take medicine against their will, and that they had a constitutional right to refuse it. Now, you know, in theory, that sounds really pretty good. You know, until you go out on the streets in Indianapolis and San Francisco and you look at all these people who are wandering around making absolutely no sense, pushing everything in a grocery cart, sleeping on a heating grate in the winter, and 50% of them are schizophrenics. And the reason why they end up that way, it was hoped that when the Supreme Court made its decision in the 1970s that all these folks would come to outpatient mental health centers and they would either get a shot or take their pills, and they would move back into society and do well. Unfortunately, what happened was that most of them left the mental hospital, went to the clinic once, and then never came back. Why? Because they don't like to take the medicine. And then as a result, then they would eventually start having the hallucinations, delusions, and they would be unemployable, and they would end up, for the most part, living on the street. So they have disorganized speech. They have grossly disorganized or catatonic behavior. Grossly disorganized means that what they're doing just doesn't seem to make any sense. Or catatonic means they sit in a chair or in a corner and don't do anything. Or catatonic means that you can position their arm like this, walk off, come back, you know, hours later, and it'll be like this. They stay in one position. They have negative symptoms, which include a flat affect. That means that they don't smile much, they don't frown much, they don't talk much, they don't express themselves well. Most of them, a significant portion of them, will have struggles at work. They'll have struggles with self-care. They have struggles with their family. The onset is in childhood or adolescence, they'll fail to achieve
whatever expected level in school they were supposed to get to. And the people who are particularly disorganized usually don't work. There are folks who are schizophrenic who have the best potential. The paranoid, well-organized schizophrenics who, if they take their medicine, can hold down jobs and can live in group homes, but the majority of them can't. The signs and symptoms have to last for 6 months. They can't have major depression or mania. They have mania. They don't have schizophrenia. I used to be that psychiatrists wouldn't give you more than one psychiatric diagnosis at a time. And good psychiatrists generally don't. They will not tell you that you're schizophrenic and you have bipolar disorder, which I would tell you really doesn't happen much. In fact, I would say it doesn't happen at all. You are either schizophrenic or you have bipolar disorder. You won't have both. And so it says you can't be diagnosed with mania and be diagnosed with schizophrenia. The disturbance can't be due to The disturbance can't be due to the physical effects of any substance. It can't be due to, if the patient has a history of autism or another developmental disorder, the schizophrenia diagnosis is only made if there are prominent hallucinations and delusions. All right, there, I'm back on track now. Moving on. So what do I think about the DSM-5 description of schizophrenia? I think it's a fairly good one. If you wanted to understand what schizophrenics are like, you could read it and come to a reasonable understanding of what was going on. And it represents what usually happens. Now, part of the problem with reading the DSM-5 is there are a lot of terms in it that aren't medical. And, that makes it difficult for non-medical people to get a notion about what it is. And, when I wrote this lecture, what I went out on Amazon and looked for was DSM-5 for dummies. Yeah, that's what I wanted. I wanted DSM-5 for dummies. It doesn't exist. But what does exist is a book called The DSM-5 Made Easy. And I think it's on the back of your, in the book list on your back. It is written by a psychiatrist, and its value is that he takes the clinical description, the DSM-5 description, and then he writes you a clinical description of a patient that he had who fit that criteria. Now, why would that be useful to you? Well, the patient, someday somebody's going to come in and they have borderline personality disorder, and you're going to want to know what in the world that means. Not necessarily that it's going to decide how you counsel them, because I don't think it should, but you really would like to understand what it is. And you could go into that book, The DSM-5 Made Easy, and you could read his description, and then you'd get an idea of what it is the psychiatrist is saying about this person. I wouldn't say that it'll change the direction of your counseling, but it might be useful to help you understand. So, I would say that the diagnosis of schizophrenia in the DSM-5 is fairly well described. Now, what was the third question? Since we counsel people and not labels, how does knowing these labels become helpful to us as data gatherers? Well, I would say that the labels are reliable, but they're not always correct. And they can be incorrectly reliable. So how should you use that? You should use it as a signpost, all right? When someone comes in and tells you, I have a diagnosis of major depression and I'm taking X number of medicines for it, should you end your conversation there? Actually, this is class participation time. I know you're close to coma at this point. And the answer is no, you shouldn't. That should just be the start. That should be the start, You want to be asking them, well, when did it start? When did this start for you? How long have you had it? What makes it better? What makes it worse? Could you describe what you do to help it?
to respond to it. Most of the time, if you talk to someone who's been depressed forever, like a fellow I've been talking to, you know, he's had a sad mood for 40 years, and most of the things that he described that he did to respond to it caused him grief all over the place, mostly because they were forged at a time before he was a believer. So almost all of his responses were unbiblical and caused him more trouble. And as he described them to me, then I understood how I might help someone who may very well have something going on in their brain that results in them having a sad mood, but did not have any significant loss in order to cause it, all right? So you use it as a signpost, an opportunity to start a conversation, a conversation that ought to be fixed with the gospel. I'm reading a book right now about probably the number one physician in the history of medicine. His name is Sir William Osler. He is responsible for much of what we call residency training in the United States today. He helped get it going. And he used to tell his students that if you'll let a patient talk long enough, they'll tell you what's wrong with them. So, you know, I would encourage you that your counselees will do the same. You know, they may need some questioning and some prompting along the way, but you know, the most important thing that you can get when a person shows up with a diagnostic label is that tells me where I'm going to start my history. Not going to affect the course of counseling. You know, again, we in biblical counseling are not problem-oriented. We are goal-oriented. You know, the goal for that counselee is still going to be, I want to glorify God with my life more than I want to breathe. So the labels are reliable, but not always correct. And you always have to keep in mind that when those labels are not correct, they may point you in the wrong direction. They're not always correctly applied. When people get a diagnosis of depression today in the United States, only 50% of the people, the clinicians, be they physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and physicians of all subspecialties or specialties, only 50% of them will use the criteria that are in the DSM-5 in order to make the diagnosis. You know, generally speaking, you know, a lot of the times it's the patient coming in and telling me that they're depressed or sad. And I listen to their story for a while, and I respond and say, well, it sounds like you're depressed and sad. You know, it is a seat of the pants, gut reaction type diagnosis. Instead of using any kind of instrument, not that I'm a fan of them, you know, I learned the criteria in the DSM-5 for depression so that I don't have to give people a PHQ-2 or a PHQ-9 or a Zung Depression Rating Scale or a Hamilton Depression Rating Scale. I know what those criteria are, and so I just ask the questions. But 50% of the guys who are making these diagnoses don't ask those questions. And what's even worse is they think they're right most of the time. They think they're really very good at it. You know, somebody did some research and looked at people who make the diagnosis of depression and treat it, and what they found out was that most of the people who are doing this, you know, without the criteria, think that they're really pretty good. They're pretty intuitive about making the diagnosis. But what they found was that they were right about 60% of the time, which means they were wrong 40% of the time, which means they were just a little bit better than a coin flip. You know, that's the truth of the matter. So, just because someone says that they have X, it does not mean they do. It just does mean that they think they do. That is important. This is it. They think they have it. Doesn't mean they do. So, what help can you get here? Well, the help is don't counsel labels. Don't argue with people about them. Get a good history, and then look at their motive in life first. You know, is there a motive? I want to glorify God with my life more than I want to breathe, or I just want to feel better. And then look at their behavior. Look at how they're responding and how they're acting. Two concepts that have guided my counseling that helped me get through the maze of the DSM-5 I've already said this evening. One is I'll never call anything a disease that the Bible calls sin. I hold to that for a really good reason. Medicine changes. Medicine changes every 5 years. You write a medical textbook today, and it is out of date within within, let's back up. Yeah. It's out of date within, before it gets printed. Yes, before the ink is dry on a medical textbook page, there'll be things in it that are out of date, and they have to put disclaimers in them to say, you know, you better check your dose before you do this because it may have changed between printing time and your time. So, medicine changes. Things that I can remember when I took the ACLS course in 1977 the first time. It was one of these white-knuckle, sweaty palm events where you had to know 25 different drugs and you had to give the exact dose at the exact right time and do everything that they thought you did or they flunked you, which meant that you wasted 2 solid days and you would have to come back and do it again later. Fortunately, I generally passed. I always passed. Now, it's down to 2 drugs. Not 2. It's down to 5 drugs at the most. You could do it in half a day. And it is not at all a sweaty palm event. And the reason why is that almost all the drugs that we used in 1976, 20 out of 25 of them we no longer use. And you know why we no longer use them? Well, we figured out, one thing, they didn't work, or two, they were hurting people. You know, medicine changed, all right? But guess what hasn't changed since 1975? Yes, the Bible. The Bible has not changed. So if you're in a situation where you're looking at the DSM-5 criteria and you're trying to get a diagnosis for an individual and the DSM-5 says that they're an alcoholic and the Bible says they're a drunk, which one are you going to go with? You know, medicine that changes, or are you going to go with the Scriptures? I would urge you to go with the Scriptures that never change. Never call anything a disease that the Bible calls sin. Now, equally, never call anything sin unless the Bible clearly does. Don't enforce your social and personal preferences on other people with the weight of Scripture. And the third thing that I use is always look for pathology. You know, if you can find a disease that has a pathologic definition, then you're in, like schizophrenia. People will come up and ask me if schizophrenia is due to demon possession. And, you know, I'll smile and say, didn't you listen to the lecture I just gave? No, the answer is no, it's not. At any rate, always look for pathology. And then the last thing that I encourage you is that as a doctor, if I'm in a situation where it's difficult to make a judgment because the diagnosis isn't clear, then I have to make a non-judgmental judgment. And I would encourage you to that. That's James 2:12-13. Speak and act as those who've been judged by the law that gives freedom, because judgment without mercy will be shown to those who are not merciful. Mercy triumphs over judgment. If things aren't clear, don't be judgmental in the assessment that you're making. All righty, that's the end of the lecture. Questions? Talked you into a coma, I did, yes. Yes?
Do you address things that have pathology, behaviors still sin in the counseling? They are sinful behaviors.
Do I address things that have pathology that are defined in Scripture as sin?
As sin.
Having
sinful thoughts caused by this disease or whatever.
Well, I'm going to use an easy example because we don't have all night. And it does get to be, it requires the ability to stand a little ambiguity. In medicine, that is always going to be true, and in life, at times, it is. The bipolar disorder guy, who, while he is manic, commits adultery. It's in my book, Good Mood, Bad Mood. It's also, it's a story that Ed Welch told. And the guy shows up for counseling with his wife. They've been separated for 10 years, I think, but not divorced. Or either they were divorced, but neither had remarried. At any rate, they were living apart. And she had decided to reconcile with him, and he came into counseling and announced that the reason why he had committed adultery was because he was manic, to which Ed Welch said, what? What would you say? Did you commit sin because you're manic, or? Come on. That's good. Where does sin come from?
Nature.
What, pardon?
Nature.
Out of our... Yes. right out of here. That's what Ed said. No, I'm sorry. Maybe the mania made it a little easier for you to make a really bad choice, but the actual, you know, choice to commit adultery came right out of your heart, because that's exactly what the Bible says about it. Now, I mean, you know, there are probably people who would be willing to argue with me about it, but that's what the Bible says. Now, so you know what the guy said? Okay. He was good with that. He confessed it. he confessed it. She forgave him. They reconciled, and he promptly had another manic episode. Poof, just like that. Except this time, he had a crowd, a cloud of witnesses. You know, the guys at church, the people from the ABF who trailed along with him all the way through it until he was back down off of the cloud that he was running on. And this time he did not commit adultery. You know, his care became subject to the church that surrounded him. So I would say that people can have pathology that affects the way that they think and can affect their actions, but when they commit sin, they're responsible for it. All right? That's the easiest answer. I can give you more complicated answers, but it'd take well beyond what we're talking about here. The lady who's drowned her five children, who thought that God, the devil, was telling her to kill her five children, she was clearly psychotic at the time. She was not connected to reality. I view that a little different, but she is where she must be. I think her husband should be in prison too, because he left her home with five kids, a new baby, to homeschool five children while he went off to work, you know, and did his really difficult job. And he's now remarried. I don't know. I don't think so. But you know, he went free. That is an ambiguous setting. But, you know, the law, and I think the law dealt with it correctly. You know, they looked at her and said, well, you know, yeah, you were crazy, but you're still going to prison. And that was how it had to be. All right, other questions? Yes.
We had a situation where this couple came in, and she had a diagnosis of a multiple personality type thing, and the husband positioned the whole family to kind of leave her, and was justified based on the, her diagnosis. And as we dug into that,
well, I'm not an expert on multiple personality disorder, and quite frankly, I don't know that anybody really is. And the reason why is because it's not a very well-defined, and it's not terribly common. But now, having said that, what he wants to know is what would I do with? Did you all hear that? Could you hear him? Sir, do you want me to repeat the question? Raise your hand if you want me to repeat the question. All right. A woman who had multiple personality disorder, her husband had arranged for the whole family to disown her, shun her, and there was some other sin issue, and he wanted to know what I thought of her, of the whole process. So what I would say off the cuff is that what were the marriage vows? Yeah, what were the marriage vows? Had she committed adultery?
She had not.
Oh, so she hadn't committed adultery. Had she abandoned? Had she abandoned him?
No.
Then I would, you know, as a pastor, I would probably have been inclined to discipline him for what he was doing, and I would say, "You married her in sickness and health, in richer or poorer. What's the other? For better or worse? Yes, that's right." And his issue would be that he doesn't particularly want to be a loving servant of his wife who struggles. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not sin on her part, but I would not have viewed that as a grounds for divorce at all. Any other questions? Going, gone. Thank you.
Alan, as well, thank you so much for going to dealing with people in their medical conditions, particularly as it deals with how they think and what's going on in their lives. Just thank you, Father, for this time. Thank you for each one who has given time to learn how to be a better counselor. We pray that you just give great grace and wisdom to them as they minister to the people that you bring into their lives. May you be the one who is honored through the work that you give them to do. Thank you for your faithfulness to us and trust you to care for us as we go from here, so that you would be honored through our lives. We ask these things in Jesus' name.
Amen. Oh, thank you.